The third difference is we have a dynamic deification as a goal. So this diamond, this dynamic understanding of our goal is very different. So for most modern Christians in the West, you say a prayer or you embrace God at some point, and you're saved. Salvation is a bar that you go over, and once you passed over it, you're in. So notice it's sort of a one-time event that you get to a place, and salvation is there. You're in heaven. You're there. And even in Augustine's understanding of salvation as beatific vision, there's something fundamentally static about it. Your goal is to gaze upon God's beauty for eternity. For Orthodoxy, the goal is quite different. For us, the goal, what we get from Jesus' salvific work, is to be so filled with the divine energies that they flow through us again. That is, as the Apostle Peter writes, to become a partaker of the divine nature. That is deification. And this simply means that the vital force within us guides us once again. The Holy Spirit is burning through our every vein. But notice that this is not a static state, but it's a dynamic state. It is a moving state. It is a moving state. And so when we talk about heaven and hell, they're not places that you go, but they're orientations on a journey. So if you are oriented towards God, then you're in heaven. If you're oriented towards death, towards trying to conquer death on your own, then you're in hell because you're separating yourself from God. But notice that heaven and hell for us are dynamic states, not static states. And so the journey in Orthodoxy to salvation is a journey. It's not a bar that you're either in or out. Deification is the active growing into God. And our ascent is unending. And this you see in Gregory of Nyssa, one of my favorite Cappadocian, the Cappadocian father, who has been my favorite since first found out about Orthodoxy, where he says, "Let us change in such a way that we may constantly evolve towards what is better, being transformed from glory to glory, and thus always improving and ever becoming more perfect by daily growth, and never arriving at any limit of perfection. For that perfection consists in our never stopping in our growth into the good, never circumscribing our perfection by any limitation. In this way, its present state of perfection, no matter how great and perfect it may be, is merely the beginning of a greater and superior stage." So in this search for true life, which is salvation, perfection is found never in finding perfection, but rather in always striving after it, always moving towards God. And so, therefore, the meaning of life is not discovered in a static state, but in a process of deification. This we see throughout the early church. And this journey into God is also a journey into love. And so when we speak about God's judgment, which we will speak about God's judgment, we shouldn't think of God as an angry judge who's going to look at us with hatred or even disappointment. In fact, we hold that God is love, and God will continue to love everybody infinitely. But we don't all receive that love in the same way. You know, so my background, being Northern European, when I get out into the sun, I might tend to burn. Why, my Greek friends get out in the sun, they get a tan and feel good and all that sort of stuff. The sun hasn't changed any. It's just our preparation for receiving that sun. In the same way, God's love doesn't change. God's going to love everybody equally. And judgment is how you receive that love. Some will receive that love, and if you've not prepared for it, will receive it as a burning, will receive it as something uncomfortable, will receive it as a struggle. And those who have prepared will receive that same love as a warmth, an embrace, and in life and love. But it's that process of going towards God and to prepare ourselves to receive God's love, or rejecting it as we go out. But no, the important thing is that it's a dynamic process, not a static state, as it is in the West. Fourth thing, a hesychastic perspective. There's a sense in Western Christianity today that religion, or really, religion is a bad word in the West. I, I, I ask my students, they have to fill out this thing at the beginning, what role has religion played in your life? And about 75% of them say, religion has played no role in my life. I'm a Christian. Like, what do you mean? It's because in certain forms of Protestant Christianity, religion is a bad word. Religion is the human attempt, and it's all empty ritual and things like that. Say, I don't have a religion, I have a way of life. I don't have a religion, I have a relationship with Jesus. That's sort of code for it, and religion becomes everything negative. But for what they see, their spiritual life or something like that, it's usually a mix of intellectual and emotional. In early Protestantism in particular, you had this debate, is Christianity something primarily intellectual, and you see this sort of John Calvin, all the Augsburg Confessions, all that sort of stuff, or is it something emotional? And emotional, you get all the great sermon people, Wesley, John Edwards, all those sort of emotional folks. And modern Christianity in the West has called a truce between those two. It's going to be head and heart. So all my students, one of the advantages of teaching Christianity is I can force all my students to go to church. And all my students have to go to a Catholic church, an Orthodox church, and a Protestant church. The fascinating thing about reading the Protestant site visits is I cannot tell them apart, unless they go to like a High Anglican, something like that, I can. Because they're all pretty much become the same thing. It's like 40 minutes of praise music, some announcements, concerns of community, 40-minute sermon, done. One song, and done. But that actually is very sort of contemporary Western Christianity now. Feed the mind, feed the heart. Emotion, intellect. Okay. The environment is not important. A lot of these big churches have nothing on the wall. Joel Osteen, who has the biggest church in America, he decided to take the cross off because some people found it uncomfortable. So there's no cross there now. And something like 44,000 people go there a week. Orthodoxy is different in this respect because we believe that the material world can be transformed by the divine. That God works through the material realm and through our bodies, which are so intertwined with the soul. So just as God can transform the waters at Jesus' baptism, so the world can be transformed with God's grace. And so I call this the hesychastic perspective because it was really what was at the heart of the hesychastic debate in the 14th century. Can the material world be transformed? Can our bodies be vehicles for prayer and divine transformation? And the result of that controversy was that we affirm fully that the material world can be transformed. That the lesson of the incarnation was that word really became flesh. And it was revealed to us that the flesh and the material world can be transformed by grace. So Mark the Ascetic writes, the word became flesh so that the flesh could become word. Right? So the flesh could become word. That is, we don't put our trust in the material world or trust in our bodies, but we are open through God working in unexpected ways through the material world. We don't just think that it's just my mind and my heart, it's just in my head or here. We think that the world can be transformed. And thus, we have miracle-working icons. We have all those lovely relics that are across the way in the church. We have chrism. We have Eucharist. We have bodily worship, where we're standing down, sitting down, we're smelling, we're hearing, we're touching. We're doing all these things because we really believe that this world, our flesh and the material world, can be transformed. And this is something that really has become distinct, because even Catholic churches, especially post-Vatican II, have become pretty sterile environments. That it's become, once again, just head, heart, material world doesn't have much of a role. So I call that the hesychastic perspective, that the material world can be transformed. The flesh can be used as a vehicle of prayer, in that sort of way. And I think we can have that because of the fifth difference, is that we really believe in life-giving asceticism. That in many ways, we can have this sort of very pro-body view because of the asceticism that balances out. So asceticism is just the training of the body for spiritual ends. It's fasting, it's temporary or permanent celibacy, sleep restrictions, other form of bodily control. And asceticism has been part of all forms of Christianity pretty much up until the 20th century. But what's changed, I think, in the 20th century in both Protestant circles and Catholic circles is asceticism has just completely gone away. I mean, the only sort of remnant you see about it, I mean, even when I was growing up, you slightly remembered Catholics having fish on Friday. But now, no one does that. I mean, you slightly remembered that Catholics would at least not eat maybe 4 hours before Mass. Now, 15 minutes if you're, if you have an issue. Now, all asceticism is for Catholics has become giving up something in Lent. You know, giving up candy or giving up something like that. It's hard to find any asceticism, broadly speaking, in the Western Church. And even temporary celibacy is treated with grave suspicion, even by some Catholic priests. And it's because it's so shifted to the mind, to the heart, that the body has seemed to just be forgotten, except for premarital sexuality, which is like the one area where they're just obsessed with. But everywhere else, there's almost no sense of the body playing a role. But Orthodoxy has retained the stress on asceticism. In part, they all say it's because we're loyal to tradition, which it may be, but it's also because I think our human understanding of the human person is different. That we say, yes, the body can be transformed in this hesychastic perspective, but the body can also operate as a thief that hijacks our souls and bounds us to the material world. And so we need to sort of break the bonds of our body and then liberate the material world, including our flesh, to be able to open itself up to authentic life. One of my favorite thinkers on asceticism is Irenaeus of Lyon, who I wanted to name our first son Irenaeus. And then my wife said, who she taught elementary school at the time, she said, no, we can't have a child named Irenaeus because anything that rhymes with your anus will be horrible on the playground. So we got a Basil instead. But Irenaeus says that the goal of asceticism is passivity before God. And it seems like an odd definition. Asceticism is passivity for God. But what he means is that we are so tied to listening to our body, to listening to the things that it wants to do, that we're actually not free to follow God. We are tied to eating and sleeping and drinking and all these sort of things, sleep that holds us tight, that we're not actually free to follow God. And so we need to try to allow ourselves to be passive before God. And asceticism for him is actively remaining passive. That is, actively trying to not be owned by our bodies. And so asceticism is an attempt to free us to stand before God and allow and be in a position for God to actually work through us. And I think we're the only church that really sees it in that way still. 100 years ago, we couldn't say that. We would never say this is a difference, especially with Catholicism that still held it. Protestants have always been a little bit suspect on this. But I think it's an important difference now. Sixth difference, worship as in a divine encounter. As I mentioned before, if you go to most services in the West, especially the evangelical ones, it's feeling the emotional needs and the intellectual needs. The value of a worship experience is how you feel. If the church isn't making you feel good, then you go to a new church. And the primary concern is if one feels closer to God, and then you learn something in the sermon. For Orthodoxy, however, the goal of worship has always been to bring the earthly to the brink of the divine, to be this journey into bringing heaven to earth, to actually stand in the presence of God. Ideally, it was every day for an hour or two, but now it's at least once a week you feel the presence of the divine. And that's not an emotional experience. Yeah, some of our fathers talk about an experience of the heart. Some call it the nous, but it's different from our emotional experience. And Orthodoxy has actually been pretty suspect of emotions. And I understand why, because I mean I can manipulate emotions. I can make all my students cry by telling the right story. I can get them all excited by telling the right joke. Right. One of the things, interesting things about. I speak sometimes at Campus Crusade, which is 800 people at Cal Poly, and their services it's just deafeningly loud rock music for 40 minutes. And I was reading a study on why people like to go to concerts, like rock concerts, and the reason why is if you hear loud music that's not threatening, actually endorphins get released in your body. It actually feels good. And so people like going to concerts because it literally, chemically, makes you feel better. I sit in Campus Crusade, super loud music that is all uplifting. Yes, they feel good. I mean, literally, endorphins are filling them, but it's not the Holy Spirit. It's chemicals in them. And so we've been pretty suspect of sort of that emotional connection. When we do liturgy, it's the common work of the people to try to elevate this world for a moment into the divine. And this plays out for us symbolically. I mean, this is something that my students never really get in Orthodox services because America is so symbolically deaf. But also even plays out in how the churches are designed. I mean, we have our altar. A lot of my students just don't understand the iconostasis. Like, why create that? And I say, look, that is supposed to be representative of the divine world. That's heaven. Everything in it is supposed to be gold or brass or something precious. When you're back there, you should be wearing a robe. Anything that comes from heaven into where heaven and earth mix, the nave, should have a candle in front of it, has incense in front of it, have fans in front of it, because you're bringing something from the divine world into the human world. When you enter into a church, you have the vestibule at the start, which is sort of the mixing place between the world and this place where you're going to mix with God. And then you stand in there and you have this encounter with God. And the first words of the liturgy, blessed is the kingdom. Well, that's the train conductor saying, this is where we're going. We're going to the kingdom. Everybody get on board. And you're going to have this divine encounter. Okay. My students are very troubled by the service because they said, I didn't feel God there. And I was like, well, it's not necessarily supposed to be an emotional experience. You're supposed to encounter God. You're supposed to have a mystical experience with God. But it's not necessarily emotional in that same way. We just have a different understanding of what the point of worship is. It's to take this world and lead it into the divine. Okay? So I think that's a difference.